You ready? Hi, Erev Tov. Good evening to all. So good to see everybody back in the Beit Midrash. So I just want to go over a quick at the beginning so we don't forget at the end. And we'll fill anybody else in who comes a little later on. I heard a couple people are coming a little after the bell. It's already a little after the bell. So this week we'll learn together this Mishnah. Next week, Rabbi Wexler's the invited guest lecturer, and we're opening the Beit Midrash. We've said to the whole public, I thought it would be on point, really wonderful, if he did something related to the class. And when we got to talking, he told me about his view on one of the Psalms and how one of the Psalms, question mark, is it their earliest Haggadah? So we're in for a treat that way, I think, because also it highlights the theme and a little bit of the way we've been asking as we've been learning the 10th chapter of Psachim, the Perek Asiri. You know, what was going on with the Seder before everybody had the printed Haggadah at their table? This is kind of the en route creativity of the rabbis coming up. It's also the dialogue between and among those sages who are Eretz Yisraeli, the Israel-based branch of the sages, and the Bavli and the Babylonian-based sages. You're going to see some of that again in our going from the next Mishnah that we're going to take on tonight. And so last week, just to remind, we talked about the Mishnah that got us into the Seder. They poured the cup of wine. They made Kiddush. We talked about how the Gemara we studied brought up issues of whether or not, you know, Ki'ilu the question, as if we were asking the question, is this Halacha Misinai? Is what we're telling you now in terms of how you make the Seder living words of God? We're going to have to make decisions one way or another. They bring up the whole tradition of Shammai and Hillel, who have differing opinions, and we have to go by one, so we go by Hillel. To answer a question that came up last week, Bobby asked it, so we'll have to fill her in when she gets here. I know. So, who said at first that Beit Shammai would be the one with whom we go in Olam Haba? In other words, if this world is Beit Hillel, who said later on that in the next world we're going to go with Beit Shammai's tradition? So it's an interesting thing because there's one reference to that statement attributed to the Arizal, Rabbi Isaac Luria, 16th century Tzfat. And there's one that wants to locate it in a discussion in the Zohar, which could be already four centuries before the Lurianic students write down what their teacher, the Arizal, teaches them in Tzfat. Attributed in this sense, that Hillel represents Chesed, which is absolute kindness and an effluence of God that is the Sfira of Chesed, which is the attribute of God's loving kindness. And then there's the attribute of Din, of great judgment, of discernment, that is over and against, in the Sfiratic tree of Kabbalah, the Chesed. So you have these two different poles, if you will, spectrum in this level of godliness, of kindness and forthcomingness and judgment and discernment, making limits. And if this world is full of, is Chesed, then the next world is Din. So if Hillel is parallel to Chesed, Shammai is parallel to Din. And Deen will rule in the next world.
not enough that we suffer in this world. We need to suffer in the next.
Ron, it was all for you. we're going to suffer. In the, it's going to be strict.
Stricter.
So anyway, so that's, to answer that. Anyway, we saw that discussion on the heels of the discussion about the second cup of wine, or the first cup of wine in the Kiddush, and what we thought about was the way that the Mishnah came, along with the narrative in the Gemara, along with the philosophical question of the Gemara, to create a kind of approach to the Pesach Seder. And we said concretely, if we recall, that we're talking about getting the night going, and they poured the first cup, and he is mivarech first on the yayin and then on the day, first on the wine and then on the day. And now we're going to go to the next Mishnah, which is on 114a2. 114a2. So we've got the first cup. I'm on 114 Aleph. And I'm on the second Mishnah on that page, which is five lines up from the bottom. Okay, so the Mishnah is going to get us to this next part of the Seder.
Kuf, what it is?
It's Kuf Yud Dalet Aleph. Vetzli A2. Aleph to the second power, to squared. Squared. How does it work in that one, Ron? Do you have Kuf Yud Dalet Aleph squared?
I have Kuf Yud Dalet Nekuda. Point dot square.
Uh-huh.
Kuf Yud Dalet dot. Square.
But you still see the superscript little
one.
Two or little
one.
Three.
One or
okay, very good. No problem. Sidri, Kuf Hei. Kuf Yud Dalet, and we're going to be here. Okay, so the Mishnah imagines that you've started the banquet of the Seder. Heviu lefanav, so they now are going to bring the next piece. Heviu lefanav, they bring before him mitabel Bachazeret ad shemagia lefarperatapat. Okay. So just that much of the Mishnah for a second. Says in the translation, after the head of the household recited Kiddush over the first cup of wine, they brought before him, now look what it says here in the art scroll, vegetables for the karpas ritual. Now that's idiomatic, and you see the note. The note says that Rashbam says, no, they bring before him all kinds of things ready for the Seder. Because he needs to have a whole supply in front of him at this point, based on what we're going to learn in the Mishnah, because we have a Seder coming up, and we need our supplies. What else do we need for a Seder? We need matzah, we need maror. But it may not be exactly that the Rashbam is talking about what happened at the time that the Mishnah was happening, or like the Mishnah was narrating the event. Why does the Rashbam have to write in his sensibility that they bring everything? Maybe because either of two possibilities, everything is really already there on the table and somehow he's got to get the tradition in on the pages of our Gemara that, no, everything is already there at the table. This whole heviu, this whole they bring it to him, it's already there, so I have to figure out where in my commentary I need to tell you that everything is there already. Or, what he's really saying at his stage of the game, the Rashbam, remember, we're talking now 13th century, okay, they brought him the first cup of wine, he made kiddush, and in the seders that I'm accustomed to, now everything comes out. By the way, mix it up a little bit one night for the children. Just have Kiddush on your Seder table. If you want to do according to what the Mishnah that we're learning really said to do, you have Kiddush, and nothing else is on the table. And then and only then do you bring everything out, including the Seder plate. Right? So you want to kind of create a Mishnaic Seder experience, you really have to change up what you're doing. That, by the way, that can create the kind of questioning that's necessary at the Seder, which is one of the whole underpinnings of the passages here and there throughout, we're going to see about asking questions being central. Anyway, back to the way they've put it in. So they brought out before him, and it says, "Mitabel b'chazeret ad shemagia lefarperet apat." Reading the next part of the translation, he dips and eats lettuce before he reaches the course that is secondary to the matzah. Okay, so then we have to go back and look. We know that the mode of eating, first of all, about mitabel, about dipping, that mode of eating is a very common, popular mode of eating. Still today in many cultures that you have dipping as the way they eat, or the way we eat. You know, what cultural experience of eating have you had where most of the meal is dipping? Right, the Eidot HaMizrach. A lot of the food is really grab a lafa, dip it in, hummus, whatever. You can have full-out chickpeas, you can have hummusim, you can have salads of eggplant and tomatoes, and you can have all kinds of falafel with, we get it in a pita, we order it, it comes, say, stuff it in. But sometimes falafel is out there on the plate, and you have lafa, you have bread of the oven, if you will, and these big, not pocketed breads, and then you take it and you scoop it up. Anybody ever eat Ethiopian food?
Yeah, big.
They bring out these trays. I sat in Givat HaMatos in Israel with Ethiopian families, and when time came to eat, the whole trays came out, and the great breads that they have, and all of the kinds of foods are sitting in front of you, and you literally take pieces of bread, and they have such method there that the bread is exactly the way they need it to fit in their hand like this, and they scoop up and they eat. Alternatively, we're talking about Greco-Roman banquets, and that's a little bit of perhaps a different type of dipping, especially with a vegetable course. But the question is, what really was this course to begin with? But we'll leave that for a second. In the Bavli, in our Mishnah, the Mishnah states pretty clearly that they bring chazeret, they bring this lettuce, which is an ancient, bitter, romaine-style lettuce. And they translate ad shemagia lefarperet apat, in this case, before he reaches the course that is secondary to the matzah. Before he reaches the course that is secondary to the matzah, farperet hapat. Just keep that in mind. Listen to this translation. This is our scroll, now we're reading from the Steinsaltz. The Mishnah says, the attendants brought vegetables before the leader of the Seder prior to the meal. Now, he has a comma if there were no other vegetables on the table. I'm going to read that same phrase, and I'm going to read it differently. The attendants brought vegetables before the leader of the Seder prior to the meal, and if there were no other vegetables, he takes chazeret and dips it before he reaches, listen to this translation, the dessert of the bread. That is, the bitter herbs which were eaten after the matzah. So which bitter herbs are we talking about? Think to the Seder. Maror. So, farperet hapat, that phrase, is translated here as the maror that you eat after the matzah. But again, what we've pointed out in translations is that oftentimes we're dealing with translating the Mishnah according to the way this Gemara explains it. The Gemara we're about to learn explains it. But if I don't really translate my Gemara in the way that I understand the Gemara to be teaching me what to do based on the Talmudic passages that are to come, and we're going to read them, let's go back and just try to translate what we've got by way of the text. Heviu lifanav. What's the problem with that phrase? They brought before him. What's the natural question? Who are the they, number one, and number two? What are they bringing? So this is an issue that stupefies from ancient commentators to medieval commentators to modern thinkers about the whole Haggadah experience. What do they really bring at that point? Because if we're trying to do the authentic practice that the sages of Bavel were doing to create the Pesach experience, I have to know what exactly the Mishnah is teaching me. Mitabel b'chazeret, so I dip, b' is the milot yachas. It's the preposition, right?
Yeah.
Preposition that I need to add it to a noun so that I can do the action with that noun. So I dip with the chazeret, which is this bitter lettuce. And when it says with the bitter lettuce, I know what's coming in the Mishnah. Listen, because the next phrase in the Mishnah, before we go to the other phrase that we've yet to ask questions about, I know that I have to think about chazeret. I have to do a double take. Do they really mean chazeret? Why do I have to do a double take? Do they really mean chazeret? Because, forget for a second, ad shemagia lefarperet hapat, which we said was the clause that meant before he reaches the course that is secondary to the matzah, because the next part of the Mishnah says the following: Heviu lefanav matzah v'chazeret v'charoset ushnei tavlishin. Af al pi she'ein charoset mitzvah, Rabbi Elazar ben Rabbi Tzadok Omer, Rabbi Tzadok says, mitzvah, charoset a mitzvah. Uva mikdash hayu mevi'in lefanav gufo shel Pesach, and in the temple area they would bring before him actual flesh from the Pesach offering. Back to what that part of the Mishnah started with. And after that round that they brought to him right after the Kiddush, the chazeret, which is the bitter lettuce, they then bring to him what? Matzah, chazeret, bitter lettuce, charoset, and the two cooked dishes. What's the issue with chazeret now? The chazeret in that last phrase of the Mishnah, this is a classic problem for those who've read this Mishnah before. The chazeret that I have, it looks like that's what's being used for what? For maror. But if I ate that same maror beforehand, chazeret, I'm really left with somewhat of an issue, somewhat of a problem, somewhat of a question. So instead of putting out there that you could possibly have something other than chazeret for that next round after Kiddush, which is the round we generally refer to as what? Karpas. We ultimately get the Mishnah telling us they bring out Chazeret, that same thing that they're going to use for Maror later, and he's going to eat Chazeret up here after the Kiddush, and he's going to dip it, Mitabel. So what do we assume that first dipping is? Into what? We imagine, because of our Haggadah, that first dipping is in salt water. However, again, we have to suspend our assumptions or our understandings of what Pesach and the Seder experience really is all about, because at this point, we're not sure, does it say Mitabel B'mei Melach? It doesn't say dip it into salt water. Does it say B'chamutz, into vinegar? I'm bringing in vinegar because ultimately the conversation is going to expand and include vinegar. And does it say B'charoset? It doesn't say B'charoset either. One might imagine that it meant dip it in charoset into this sweet stuff because, oh, just like if we eat this bitter something on a Seder night down the line after matzah, and before matzah, after matzah, this is a whole discussion too, we might think that if we eat it earlier, we have to dip it into the charoset, just like we do later. Or we might say, no, lehefech, oppositely, we dip it later in the charoset, therefore we shouldn't dip it into charoset now, and maybe we eat it plain. Because there's not a little drush here in the Mishnah that says, and the karpas comes because it's beautiful springtime, or the chazeret, the green of the lettuce. There's not a nice little drush that says, you bring it because you're going to now remember the tears of those who were enslaved. Though we've attributed meaning like that to the round of karpas in our experience, the Mishnah is plainly terse. And by being terse and using an economic way of approaching the verbiage, we have to decipher what's really going on. The Mishnah might have assumed, by the way, that we totally understand that it meant if there are no other vegetables around, you could use chazeret just like you use it later for maror. That's like a very simple explanation, right? Very easy to explain it like that. But you're still left with problems because the rabbis want to do mitzvot in a way that the mitzvah is pure, clear, and has meaning and stems from a Torah verse, or at least has some kind of support in the Torah or the Tanakh to tell you exactly why you're doing this mitzvah. And what is this round? Maybe it's just the mitzvah of creating questions. Overall, the Higadat al-Bincha, and I can put it in the rubric of, I told this story to my children, and in order to tell the story to my children and make this night different, I had Kiddush with nothing on the table. They brought out for me this little table in front of me. Remember, we're talking about individual little tables and not the whole banquet kind of table, because we're talking about ancient times and the Mishnaic times. And maybe this now is the way that I'm going to eat. I'm going to eat in the same way that they do in the Greco-Roman banquet theater that we've adopted for our freedom banquet of Pesach, and I'm going to dip this chazeret, that which I was going to use later. Maybe the simpler explanation is, yeah, it's going to be, I'm going to confuse everybody at the table. I thought you were supposed to use that for maror. That's the most bitter herb we have. Why are you eating it now? Before the matzah. By the way, I couldn't find anybody to say that question. But I thought of that today as I'm reviewing the Gemara. Why are you eating that now? Shouldn't you eat that after? To ultimately allow for the teaching of the order of the achilat matzah and the achilat maror, the eating of the matzah and the eating of the bitter herb, in its proper place with the proper intention. But I haven't found that yet, and I cannot be the first one to think of that question. So I'm going to keep looking. Yeah?
One thing I'm puzzled by is, chazeret is one of those things that I never knew what it was. And a lot of Seder plates have a spot for karpas, have a spot for Malur, okay, and also have a spot for Chazera.
Yeah. Right.
Does this come from this? I mean, because it suggests yes, three separate
rituals. This comes from this. This comes from this. Because there are people who eat Chazeret for Karpas, and there are people who eat Karpas for Karpas. Every Haggadah that we have around these parts, around these lands, has kept the name Karpas. That's basically because that name stuck post Maimonides. Karpas is a Persian.
Seder plate that would make everybody happy because
exactly,
would
exactly. Karpas is a Persian word, which is also an Aramaic word, and it translates in ancient Persian, ancient Aramaic, to celery. So anyone who uses parsley, by the way, you know, again, since Maimonides and anything green goes, and there's lots of discussion in the halachic codes, when you can't find one, you use another, and it's green, and we're attaching it to the springtime, and all that kind of jazz. So Karpas stuck as the name of that place in the Seder, and that list of Seder steps in the beginning of many Haggadot, Kadesh, right? That list includes Karpas. So Karpas stuck. Yeah, all right.
How did potato come about?
Oh, so...
Because now that's...
Here,
since anywhere I've gone, it's always been the potato.
Right, so here's the big question. What is really happening in this Mishnah? If it is, when there are no other vegetables available, use the chazeret you're going to use later for maror, for the bitter herb, then we can understand, potentially, why it had to single out mitabel b'chazeret in the second phrase of the Mishnah. Maybe, though, heviu lifanav, maybe the direct object of that heviu, which we said, what is it? And we still don't know who they are. But we imagine they are the servants who we mentioned in a couple pages ago that they had to sit down, and if they ate matzah quickly, they did their mitzvah of matzah, but they kept serving. And we assumed, and we imagined they were males, and we imagined that they were males who had the obligation. So that's the they. Maybe it meant they bring before him all kinds of vegetables to dip right after this kiddush. Now, in what, again, I'm holding out. I'm not answering that. In what? I don't know. Dip in what? I don't know yet. I want to hold out a little. And when there's no other vegetables available, as we said, they bring before him chazeret, even though I'm going to use it later for maror, right? So the answers to the question of what's going on with karpas and what could it be, really we could learn from maror itself that the night might be a night of completely eating all kinds of bitter herbs, both at the beginning and later on. Chazeret we might reserve for the later on Maror to make it a special kind of bitter herb experience, a bitter experience. And there's a Mishnah. Is it a Mishnah? Hold on 1 second. Yes, I marked it and I'm flipping pages. These are the vegetables through which a person fulfills his obligation on Pesach, Mishnah Pesachim 2:6. Okay, this is talking about maror, but could it also be talking about the course of vegetables that happens if we want to make the vegetable tied in with a theme we already know exists with maror, and that is bitterness? Because again, I don't see in the Mishnah some nice drush about this being the time to celebrate spring. And the saltwater theme, of course, references more the theme of bitterness than it does the spring theme anyway. So if I'm using chazeret for maror as the ideal vegetable for maror, the bitter romaine type of lettuce, the ancient one that's really, really bitter, maybe these other vegetables that I could fulfill with maror become the vegetables that I use for the first course. Opening the door, Ari, to answer your question, to say, possibilities of other vegetables have been on the table, no pun intended, since the time of the Mishnah. Here are the other types. Ve'elu yirakot she'adam yotzei behen yidei chovato. These are the type of vegetables that a person can use to fulfill the obligation. Chazeret, lettuce, number one being the most ideal, in my opinion. Uve olshin, endives. Uve tamcha, something called gingidium, a plant of the family of carrots that grows in Syria and is very bitter. Uva charchavina, a ringo, uva maror, which is, in their translation here, sanchus. Again, these, I believe, are all types of root vegetables that are very, very bitter. Now, there's no horseradish there, by the way. Hold that thought for a minute when it comes to maror. Come back to potato for karpas. Celery grows in only certain kinds of places. And when it comes to vegetables in season, during the Pesach cycle, I might not be able to find anything really, really wonderfully green where I live. So I need some alternatives. So people, you have families that use potatoes and use turnips because they are fruits of the earth. And one possibility of the Gemara, especially in Pesachim, in the Jerusalem Talmud, is that my bracha for that fruit or vegetable needs to be borei pri ha'adama, the fruit of the earth. And what's more of the earth, even more than celery, than a potato or a turnip? And that's the ultimate workout in our Gemara too, that this is the foreshadowing. You know, if you want to know, you've had these Seder experiences, so it's not like breaking the news. We don't say ala maror or ala achilat maror here. We don't say upon eating the maror. We say on the fruit of the earth, right? At the karpas level of the experience. So no mystery that we had to find the right one to fulfill our obligations. And it had to be local, and it had to be fresh, and it had to be of the earth. Just let me read you a little bit of from the Shechter Haggadah. The Mishnah does not say what they bring in front of them. This absence led to additions in some manuscripts, as they bring vegetables in front of them. The missing direct object has puzzled traditional commentators and modern critical scholars alike. Friedman suggests that the Mishnah should have read, they bring in front of him lettuce. He dips the lettuce. But the Mishnaic editors abbreviated the language in order to avoid repetition. In any case, it's clear that at least one of the appetizers brought in front of the Seder participant was lettuce. Now, if some of them added lettuce, perhaps it was because we wanted to teach what is in the Gemara in the next section, right after the Mishnah, which is a beautiful sugya about what we do when we are eating the self-same item for this part of the Seder versus the mitzvah of eating maror. And it gets a little bit more philosophical and less technical about what exactly it is and how long you have to eat it and how much time you have, those kinds of things. We're now going to go into a different realm. That realm is intentionality. The realm that we're going to explore of practicing mitzvot is all about kavanah in the next section of the Gemara. And I find this to be wonderful and fascinating and lovely that it's talking about a mitzvah that's done on a Seder night where you've got the whole family together. The kids are either geshraying or they're trying to stay awake, or you're trying to get them to stay awake, or you're doing a little bit of making sure that happens if you want to fulfill that by way of even some of the other sources. The Tosefta mentions that after you eat this lettuce, you can actually distribute matzah to the young children, you know, because we have this kind of like fear of eating matzah before it's time. Well, the Tosefta in Brachot for sure said pass around matzah. The Gemara doesn't want you to pass around matzah. The Gemara wants you to do parched grains and, like, you know, parched grains and kisnin, perhaps even like sweeter little elements, or not. No appetizers except for what you've got going on here. There's a whole discussion in that sense. But to give the kids something to keep them engaged. And again, keep the whole question of whether or not we eat any kind of larger portion of appetizers at the Karpas ritual moment. Keep that aside for a minute because we'll come back to that. But here in our Mishnah, since it is about the same item we're going to use later, comes the Gemara and wants to know about how we're going to deal with this notion that we now seem to be eating what it is we're going to use for the mitzvah of Maror later. So what's going to be the problem with that? What's going to be the question? Well, if I ate the chazeret now, and that's what I'm using for my Maror mitzvah later, haven't I already really done the mitzvah of eating Maror? So now the philosophical question, top of page Kuf Yud Dalet Bet. Amar Reish Lakish. So Reish Lakish asks or says, teaches, Zot Omeret, the fact that the Mishnah teaches that one eats the same lettuce twice, this indicates what? Mitzvot Srichot Kavana. That when I do mitzvot, I need to have full intentionality on the mitzvah that I'm doing. Kevan delo ba'idan chiyuv demaror hu da'achile. Since it is not at the time for fulfilling the maror obligation, when one eats that first portion of lettuce, bevorei pedri adama hu da'achile. He eats it only with the bracha who creates the fruit of the ground. And of course he has kavanah that it's from the fruit of the ground, and he has this sense that he's eating something from God above, below, and that it's meaningful, this eating, because he's made a bracha. It's not the bracha of the mitzvah of eating maror, and therefore I have not fulfilled, or I don't say that he has fulfilled this commandment. V'diyoma lo ichavin l'maror. And so perhaps he didn't have intent for that mitzvah of maror. Hilkach ba'e l'medar l'atabu le l'shem maror. And therefore, later on, he has to dip that lettuce again for the sake of maror, and ultimately in his Seder experience, say the bracha with the intention that in fact this dipping is for the dipping of the maror mitzvah, and my bracha was for the eating of the maror, and mindfully I have to fulfill this mitzvah as much as the physical act of eating this maror dipped in charoset will be at that part of the Seder that I do it. Now, de'isa kedatach mitzvah lo baya kavana. If it enters your mind, if you would say that a commandment does not require intentionality, lamalach trei tibule, why do you need two dippings? Why is it necessary to eat the lettuce the first time and dip, and then the second time and dip? Can't you just say, you just did the mitzvah over here? And even though it didn't seem like it came at the right time, if that's the only vegetable, and let's add that dimension. And if that's the only vegetable you have, and I'm going to bring him the chazeret, and he's going to eat the chazeret, and that's what I need to do to fulfill the mitzvah of maror, I just say he fulfilled it. V'ha tabilei chadazimna. He's already dipped and eaten it once, and that should suffice for fulfilling the mitzvah of maror. Gemara is going to, though, challenge the argument. Mimai, what proof do you have that in fact we could assume or claim that he's fulfilled this mitzvah of eating maror, of eating the bitter herb, with all of its accompanying thought reality and all of its symbolism and all the fulfillment of a verse of Torah that is necessary? Dioma la'ola mitzvot ein tzrichot kavana. Perhaps in truth, commandments don't require intent. Udika Amart, and as for that which you said to prove otherwise, Trei Tibule Lamali, why do I need the two dippings? Ki Hechi Deleyeha Vehekara Latinokis. I shall answer you that the second dipping is needed so that there will be a distinguishing factor for attracting the attention of the children. And thusly what? I need these two dippings not for the reason you said, but to fulfill what I ultimately know is also a deoraita mitzvah. Vihi gadat al bincha. I have this mitzvah of teaching my children, and I have this mitzvah of actually mixing things up enough to have them wonder about this night and start asking me some questions so we get the soil tilled here so that we can really explain what's going on. V'chitema, and if you should say, or you should provide, you know, you should answer me, Imkain, if that's so, that the Mishnah mentions these two dippings only to teach children, Lishma'inan Shar Yirakot, then let the Mishnah teach us this by using the example of other greens. Let's use others. Use any type of vegetable for karpas other than chazeret. Because that's going to create the curiosity, and usually in great banquets we only dip once, so now you're telling me we're going to dip twice. You got to really have him, in a halachic kind of sense, pursue getting something else other than the chazeret. If the Gemara wasn't trying to teach me something about the principle of intentionality with regard to mitzvot, it wouldn't say chazeret twice. And I'll answer you, if the Mishnah had taught us by using the example of other greens for the first dipping, I would have said following, it is where there are other greens available that we require two dippings. You might have said, the only time you really need two dippings is when you have Shar Yirakot. You would have said, if you only have one, then you finished with the mitzvah when you ate the first time. However, where there's only one, that is the lettuce, you don't need the two dippings. Kamash malan, it then comes to teach us, dafilu chazeret va'inan trei tibule. And even where you have the chazeret, you absolutely need these two dippings in order to be a distinguishing factor for attracting the attention of the children. The Gemara now cites an explicit refutation, though, of Reish Lakish. V'od Tanya, right? What does Reish Lakish ultimately claim, by the way? Mitzvot tzricho kavanot, right? That mitzvahs need intention. Taught in a Braita. So it's going to go on to try to prove them wrong. So what's at the core? What principle here are we talking about that can be somewhat of a difficult issue to this very day, regardless of what community you come from in Jewish life? We're talking about an issue that the great thinker Leibowitz dealt with in Israel, talking about an issue that's prevalent in halachic codes to this day when it comes to prayer, when it comes to Megillah, when it comes to Shofar. We're talking about the overarching philosophical question of whether or not my ritual act, my doing something like listening to the shofar, my eating this and not really thinking about the commandment to eat this, have I really fulfilled my obligation? Or oppositely, equally and oppositely, we're talking about the issue of the hopes of Chazal, that when we perform certain ritual acts, that even if it's with the same two items, same, you know, two portions of the same item, that we can distinguish mindfully between how we eat this, why we're eating this, and how we eat that, and why we're eating that. Or take, for instance, the shofar. I might hear the shofar, but I might really have intention to do the mitzvah of hearing the shofar. And for the rabbis, that's a very important concept. So the example of the chazeret being the one item that comes right after the Kiddush gives us the possibility that we're going to use the Seder experience to be mindful about the self-same item being eaten at our table. And really performing a mitzvah on the one hand, and creating this Seder experience over here on the other hand, at this point, why? To arouse the curiosity of the children. In everyday Jewish life, there's this question. I mentioned Lagos. He said, listen, it can't work like that. People are not going to experience Jewish living doing mitzvot with the kind of kavanah that ultimately one would think the rabbis are hoping for when they bring up such philosophical considerations in the performance of mitzvot. That one can fulfill a mitzvah even if one is not all the way there, let's say. Now, I don't know how this works in your professions, but I want you to think about this for a second. Can someone in any of the professions that you deal with really perform what they need to do, sometimes almost mechanically, robotically, or just because that's what to do, the right thing to do, and not have that kind of true intentionality of fulfilling their obligation, either to the profession or to the individual or whatever way that works itself out? Right? Think about this for a minute.
Happens all the time.
So in what sense? Can you give an example of how it manifests in your field?
Sports, which is very easy. You see professional athletes that make millions of dollars, and occasionally they don't try as hard as they can. They don't run down to first base as fast as they can. You know, they take it easy. Versus others that do. So they're getting paid the same. They have an obligation to perform. And sometimes they do, and sometimes they don't.
Right. So some athletes will tell you, like, when I'm in the zone and I can really be there, that's like explaining kavanah, right? And otherwise, I'm just kind of there.
Going through the motion.
Not skating as fast. Not moving without the ball. Whatever you want to say.
But kavanah is something so unique. It's this is a religious thing to me. I mean, I've always wanted to catch it and to have it. And you want it. And to get it is very difficult to get the kavanah. At least to me, in my perspective.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's come back to that. Barry, what were you going to give as an example?
In my profession, there are a lot of physicians who go and do work that is perfectly appropriate to get the job done without necessarily having their whole heart in the relationship with the patient and all of the rest. It happens as a... And the fact that someone is skilled doesn't change that. They can go and do their thing.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think what leadership is all about is, in fact, encouraging people to go beyond that. People won't get paid if they don't do their job, but knowing whether or not they're doing their job to the best of their ability or just to meet the minimum requirements is always a challenge for leadership.
Mm-hmm.
I always look for the people who are obsessed with their work. So when I want to hire somebody, I want somebody who's like obsessed with wanting to be there and get it done. If you're just sort of floating, you're kind of boring.
Mm-hmm.
Step.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, for me, I guess the medical area comes to mind as it's a good place to find an example of the difference between doing it with kavanah and not. You could have a surgeon who is technically just an amazing surgeon, does that procedure right, does it perfectly every time, but maybe isn't, you know, just always wants to do the job right, but maybe isn't thinking that it's important to do the job right because of the patient's welfare. And that for me is sort of the Kavanah piece, is when you're thinking about more than the correct, perfect execution of the task, you're adding another element on top.
See, I think the Kavanah that you're talking about religiously, Debbie, definitely might sit in a category all its own if you're talking about that total inspiration, Kavanah, to walk around the sense of, you know, at one with oneself, at one with one's community, at one with God. You know, that's I think, not even the Kavanah that the rabbis here ultimately aspire to. I really believe that. Though they want that at some point, that tevekut, that clinging, that later is really defined as tevekut, I don't think that that's the Kavanah that the Gemara is talking about or that the codes are talking about when they start talking about Kavanah with mitzvot. Just to put that on the table. Though I think it's wonderful to aspire to that and would say you can find that in here. You really can. But I'll liken it a little bit to this example in the shul sense. I love when people come to shul for the social. I love that, right? I love when there's a meal and it's a Shabbos meal and it's social and we're doing it and we're living it. It's not the fight between the wrong and the right here. It's the kind of possibility of you come for the social, you come to connect, and then if you really have a sense that you've fulfilled an obligation that Torah has demanded, and you can live with that sense of fulfilling this obligation that literally is like, because Sinai is echoing and it's calling and there are what to fulfill to stitch the cosmic order back together and to ultimately here both go back and forward, celebrate redemption and think about what redemption is going to be in the future. If you're thinking, because Kavanah for the rabbis, I think, in the truest sense of the early Rishonim defining Kavanah, is a lot to do with, and it's a very Jewish take on this, right? In this way, it's very much about understanding why you're doing what you're doing and acting and gleaning the meaning. So the Rambam wants to say that Kavanah and davening, even though we like to think about this experience of this kind of what I call dveku, this clinging to all these dimensions, and we don't remove ourselves from clinging to reality and really loving life and physicality and the corporeal experience of it all as much as we are sailing in the upper worlds, if you will, with Kavanah. But the Rambam calls Kavanah davening building your understanding of the words you're saying on a constant level in your life and understanding what they mean on the page and understanding what, and I'll add this dimension, what understanding what gateways they open for you to bring your life experience into the prayers and what to associate with some of the words, even individually. Ahava comes, think about love and what love is and where you get love from and how you give love, all these kinds of, you know, real life things. Kavanah at the Seder table is to really make the symbols really mean something. And so when you're eating maror and you're tasting the bitter herb, the question is, can you feel generations ago, only decades ago, the suffering of your people? Because we're not afraid to say that Kavanah is also about feeling the suffering. But at the same time, can you feel the great joy of the redemption and the family going out of that suffering and being released from that suffering? So these moments in the meal really becoming meaningful, really becoming powerful. And
I think there's a big difference, though, because when you first started talking about Kavanah, it was very personal and individual and very inner reflective. The thing that's so wonderful about the Seder is that it's a perpetual communal event. So it's no longer, it would seem to me, it's no longer kavanah just for the individual.
Correct.
In isolation to the rest. The idea is whether or not you can make a seder in which the kavanah is truly communal.
I think it works both for the Jew all the time. I have to, it's kind of like Soloveitchik's notion of the lonely man and then being part of Knesset Israel all at the same time. Right? For Rav Soloveitchik, you never stop understanding that you alone were created in the Garden of Eden. At the same time, you are never dissociated. And we've talked a little bit about this in other terms. You're never dissociated from Knesset Israel, from the great body, the monolithic communal experience. So one has to attach oneself in that sense. But halachically, I think for Rav Soloveitchik, it did come out through the halachic framework, through the notion of mitzvah, I ultimately gain meaning because, yes, I fulfilled, but ultimately because we were redeemed and we were commanded.
I still think it's different in a synagogue where you're individuals, even though you're part of the congregation, than when you're engaged around the Seder table, where the sense of the collective is really the essence and unique feature of it. So I think they are different, because the breaking bread and eating is from time immemorial. I mean, there's all sorts of evolutionary stuff about, if you want to look at cultures, there are no cultures in which people don't go to the bathroom in private and don't eat communally. And so they hearken back to the fact that we have almost certainly shared the benefits of the hunt, because that was really an important thing for social cohesion and for demonstrating fairness in the group. So I think there's a reason that we celebrate Pesach around the table rather than in synagogue. And I think that makes it a different experience.
I hear you. I think we'd have to put all this together. What you're reminding me of is the nice and distinct component of what's in the liturgy still to this day, right? Hayav Adam lirodet atzmo ki'ilu hu yatzam Mitzrayim. An individual person is obligated to see him or herself as if he personally or she personally went out of Egypt. And then, hotzi anu mimitzrayim, right? God took us out collectively. And each household around their table was part of the ultimate collective Knesset Yisrael, that great assembly of Israel. And I think that the powerful notion of kavanah, I thought you were, and with this I take the critique, if we were talking about individual professionals doing their job or not doing their job with intentionality, mindfulness, my analog was not exactly complete, right? Because I was going to the place where I think the rabbis are, which is both individually and collectively, we can be in this space of connecting ourselves. But point taken, that the meal is what creates that shared sense of, if we shared from the hunt and celebrated that, we share this meal as hunters or as thinkers now, because we're using the Greco-Roman banquet, or as nation builders. And Lahavdil, we're making our nation building banquet not the Greco-Roman banquet, but the great Seder and the great celebration of freedom. So we have this intentionality with the whole enterprise when it comes to putting our layers of meaning on this. Yeah. All right. What I want to do is move back to the details of this lettuce and the dipping. Turn to 114b2. We're just skipping a little bit of the Gemara. And it's Tanaehi, which is for those with just the Hebrew, following the Hebrew. Tanai is, about halfway down. Like, if you look at, I'm still on 114B, this page, no, this one, yeah, about halfway down, look where the Rashbam is on the inside gutter of the page, put your finger on the Rashbam and go over your exit, about there, Tanaihi. The first word on the line that I have is paras, but it may not be what you've got. All right, so Tanai. Whether or not commandments are required intent is disputed by Tanaim. The Tanya, as it says, Rabbi Yossi Omer, Afal Pisha Tibel B'Chazeret, even though he dipped and ate lettuce for the Karpis ritual, Mitzvah V'Havi Lifanav Chazeret V'Charoset Ushnei Tavshilin, it's a commandment to bring before him another portion of lettuce, charoset, and two cooked dishes. The Gemara persists in that challenge. V'Akati, still in light of the Braita, even though it sounds like even though he dipped that for karpas, Dilma kasava Rabbi Yossi mitzvot ein srichot kavana. Rabbi Yossi may hold, in fact, commandments don't require intent. Dehai deveinan trei tibule, and that which we require two dippings, the second course of lettuce, is not in order to fulfill the mitzvah of maror. Ki hechi detehe vehekara latanoket, so that there shall be a distinguishing factor for attracting the attention of children. The Gemara ultimately defeats this challenge. Im kein my mitzvah. If so, what's the sense of it? It's a commandment to bring lettuce. Okay, so that's the end of that little piece. My shnei tavshilin. Now it's going to ask a little bit about what the foods are. But before we go here, I just want to read to you another piece about karpas. So we said, and we hold, that the Tanaim are shaping the Seder's menu in the pattern of the typical Greco-Roman customs. And in the Tosefta in Pesachim, it says the following. That the Shamash dips meats and places them before the guests when it comes to the Karpas moment. And even though there's no proof for this practice, there's something reminiscent of it, or there's something to hang it on in terms of our texts. It's a pasuk in Jeremiah, break up the untilled ground and do not sow among thorns. Meaning, got to whet the appetite. In contrast, the Babylonian Talmud says the following. Amar Rav Asi aval matbil hu b'mine targima. Rav Asi says, but you can dip all sorts of like little dessert sweets. Rabbi Yitzchak matbil b'yarke. But Rabbi Yitzchak would dip vegetables. Ultimately, this appears pages before our current page, where we've got chazeret on the menu, and not meats, and not any kind of desserts, but we have vegetables. Commentaries want to go back and say it's more like Rabbi Yitzchak, who would dip vegetables. It was also taught in a Braita, the servant dips meats and places them before the guests, and even though there's no proof for this practice, there's something reminiscent. That was the verse we had. Now, what's the Braita doing there after it says Rabbi Yitzchak eats vegetables? What a Braita normally does. Tries to come and uproot what the last conclusion was to prove that you could eat these little desserts. Rava, hava shtei chamra kulei. Rava would drink wine all the day before Pesach in order to whet his appetite so that he would eat more matzah at night. But what's the problem with that? You're not supposed to have anything, according to the first Mishnah we learned in our chapter.
I thought they said little meats and fruit.
Ah, so the question is, what was left as possibilities? It seemed like from some of the Gemara that there were people eating little things. Now, here's what we say. In this source, there's confusion between two topics. The prohibition of eating a meal after mincha on the day before Pesach, which was our first Mishnah in the chapter, and the custom of eating appetizers at the Seder itself. Section 3 originally referred to appetizers eaten at the meal. In other words, this little section about desserts and vegetables and meats. It's unclear whether Rabbi Asi or Rabbi Yitzchak would eat during the day or after the Seder had begun, but the latter seems more likely, after the Seder had begun. They were Eretz Yisraeli. They were in Israel, and this could have been the Israeli custom. Furthermore, in Yerushalmi Pesachim, the question is asked, is it permitted to eat tragama v'kisnin, these little sweets, after mincha, before the Pesach Seder? And the response is, Rabbi Chiya taught, it is forbidden for a person to eat anything until it gets dark. Therefore, what? They ate them at the time we consider to be the Karpas ritual with the vegetable. So that appetizers seem to be an Israeli custom, a little bit more expansive than just the vegetables or even the chazeret, the lettuce, that we might bring to teach a point at the Seder table, that is, that you got to have the right kavanah, the right intentionality later on when you're eating maror. By the time you get to Rava in the 4th century in Babylonia, it's clear that he's drinking wine on the day preceding Pesach. This is a means to increase his appetite later at night. I don't know if that works for you, but it doesn't for me. In light of this statement, the editors of the Sugi assume that all the other statements in the Sugi refer to a time before the meal has begun. It seems that by 4th century Babylonia, substantial appetizers were not eaten at the beginning of the meal. And the only appetizer that remains is the lettuce, sanctioned explicitly by the Mishnah. It's possible that to compensate for the lack of appetizers, which would have meant waiting until much later to eat, they allowed some eating during the afternoon before the meal. In contrast, in Eretz Yisrael, they forbade eating during the day, but allowed for a rich course of appetizers once the meal had already begun. So, if you want to again, mix things up.
Trying to satisfy the varying needs of people.
Maybe. And think about the meal itself and how you're going to create this experience at night and how you're going to keep people engaged, awake, how the kids are going to stay awake. And so in Noam Zion's Hartman Haggadah called A Different Night, he brings up this issue of the Eretz Yisraeli custom of having all kinds of appetizers, and he brings up the fact that, and he makes reference to the following text that he doesn't put in that Haggadah, that there are all kinds of blessings that were said, four different blessings, over the fruit of the ground, over the fruit of the tree, over the fruit of the land and the fruit of the tree, over the land and over the delights, ala aretz v'ala ma'adanim, and a blessing that basically recognizes that God sustains the earth and everything alive. And there are suggestions that appetizers from several categories can be served at that time in the Seder, not only borei priya adama, the fruit of the earth, because Rabbi Yitzchak would dip vegetables, we dip vegetables, but also perhaps fruits of the tree, borei priya eitz, also perhaps small meats, she'akol nievid varo, and if you think about then later Ashkenazic practice, anybody's family at Karpas also bring out eggs?
We do it before we start.
Oh, so, but some do, right?
Yeah.
So there's another kind of tradition that came from those four different blessings I mentioned, where they actually brought out, get this, rice with sugar and a fried egg.
All together? That's like a meal? Like
that's like part of the appetizer course.
It's appetizer.
Because you obviously have some who eat that full rice. We're going to see in our Gemara that it says, of course, that rice is one, there's one position in a braisa that holds. Rice is a type of grain. And even with rice matzah, I can do my mitzvah of matzah, right? That's the hook. That's the actual platform on which any acceptance from a Talmudic era level of kidneyot, of eating rice, comes from. We studied this last year when the tshuva was created, when the responsum was created by the conservative movement. That's really where they have the Talmudic era anchor or platform to do this from.
Have you ever been to a Seder where they have these appetizers and
Well, truth be told, what we do at Karpas is use some of this methodology. and we bring out, well, there's a machloket rishonim, there's a big argument in our family. The Boltons did it with celery. The Halpers did it with parsley.
Oh.
But how you could eat enough parsley to really fulfill the blessing, you're supposed to eat certain amounts, so not that I'm exact on scales, but I can eat a lot more celery than I can parsley. So we serve both. And we also have dipping sticks of other vegetables that are adama. And instead of just dipping in salt water, we sometimes have kind of another kind of dipping, which they say that you can dip in vinegar in the Tosfot. So the notion that you can have like a little bit of a vinaigrette, Pesach vinaigrette, of course. So you make a vinaigrette, you dip carrots in. And since Adama is also the blessing for bananas, we have also used bananas, because that's not eights. But there are those... No, it's a plant, and it doesn't grow again. So anytime you take a banana branch off the plant, it's literally coming, quote-unquote, from the earth. And you bless Adama.
What do you dip?
Well, they make great almond butter, and since Rabbi Akiva said you gave your children roasted nuts, you dip it into almond butter, and it's such a treat. And I don't feel as though the walls are collapsing on me. So
people will sit longer before the main meal.
And people will sit through my magid, and it's lovely. And it's really something that I recommend, and it's very much in line with sourceful Judaism. And it's wonderful. It's just wonderful. There are those who would say, absolutely could never see myself doing such a thing on a Pesach evening. And I get it. As I said to you, after learning all those sources about kidney oat and how wonderful it goes right back to the Gemara and the possibilities of rice, that my rabbi at home says, absolutely not. That's it. So I don't ask questions. But she was into the appetizer round. The whole idea of dipping, by the way, just to point it out, is in the Tosafot itself, because there are a lot who feel, what's the dip? The dip is into haroset. Because if I'm going to do the mitzvah with chazeret, maybe it's a warm-up to do that. And maybe it's, again, the explanation that I gave, no, this isn't the mitzvah time, but why are you doing it like the mitzvah? Makes sense to me that the kids see, because that was the reason why we were given in the brightas about doing mitzvah with intentionality. Makes sense to me that the kids would see me doing it exactly the same way, but have to ask questions about it. Why aren't you saying the blessing over Maror if you're doing this exactly the same way? So again, leaving that aside, if I dip it into Harosa now, it seems like though I might really be doing the mitzvah. And if mitzvot don't need intentionality the way that the Gemara suggests they do, then if I've dipped it into the charoset, the Tosafot come along and say, you know what, this whole thing with dipping into charoset, that lettuce that they used, you needed to dip it into charoset because of kappa. Kappa is a worm, a poisonous worm, that's sometimes in that kind of lettuce. And when you put the charoset onto the chazeret, the worm would run away. Or it would nullify the poisonous effect. Now you can tell us more about that. Meanwhile, the Tosfos then go on and say, but we don't have such a dipping at our Sedarim. To summarize, they say, we use either salted water, or particularly they use a very sour vinegar. And that begins the connection to the embittered lives of those who experienced the slavery, versus just the Brei Pri Adamah and the giver of all life, as with the blessings over many food. That, by the way, when I read those blessings, I intimated that they were from the Talmudic era. But in fact, those blessings were brought down by Goldschmidt in quoting an early Eretz Yisraeli Haggadah, an early Israeli Haggadah from 1960. Goldschmidt found that and published it.
Can I just make sure I've got this right?
Yes,
yeah. I probably don't. So the whole idea of dipping twice, which is a big thing, and I've never been able to answer that question because I never really understood, but maybe does that mean we're going to do the Hazarah twice, once as an hors d'oeuvre and once with the intentionality of the mitzvah? Is
correct.
The two dippings?
Correct. That's really the two dippings. And it makes sense to me, based on the Mishnah and the Gemara, that once, if it was with Haroset in the past, that once was a Ful Janau, made a blessing like they make blessings over appetizers at other banquets, but I'm really not doing my mitzvah, I'm going to now go and do a different course where I dip, which was completely unlike the regular framework of the banquet, or it was a dipping in some other something, which it became, especially in Ashkenaz, as the Tosfot included, and those are the two dippings. Once, the dipping of the vegetable into salt water or vinegar, and now these other dippings that I'm suggesting because of the just act of dipping and not the symbolism of embitteredness, because there's nowhere that tells me that this dipping must be about the embittered lives of anyone, even though it's with salt water, that we usually do this and we attribute that. And two, the dipping of, what is the dipping, by the way, at that mitzvah of maror? It's the maror root or maror vegetable in haroset. I've also seen some people in that moment, because they just broke matzah, make the mistake of then dipping matzah into bitter herb. But that's not the mitzvah there. The mitzvah there, after you eat motzi matzah, is to dip the bitter herb into the charoset. So you have the two dippings as we have them in our Haggadah. It's explained by a lot of folks. One, the embittered lives of slavery up front, yet with the rebirth and growth of the spring-like world around us. That's the hors d'oeuvre. And then the dipping of the bitter herb into the charoset to do the mitzvah of maror.
That's not... Wait a minute. And then you have the Hillel.
So what is the Hillel sandwich, actually? We're going to get to that in the Gemara.
Yeah.
If we want to, we can just say that the Hillel sandwich serves a very different purpose.
A clean matzah, maror, biyasad, or something like that?
So the Hillel sandwich where you eat matzah, maror together, but without the what now? Without the Pesach offering.
Right.
He used to do it with the Pesach offering. That is because, and this is the foreshadowing, we'll read it inside, he thought that you needed to have all of them together in order to fulfill the mitzvah. You know, that you just had to put them all together. So instead of saying, we're going to fulfill the mitzvah of eating matzah and maror now, like Hillel, what did we do? We say it's Zecher LeMikdash. We say it's in memory of the time that the temple stood and Hillel ate matzah and maror along with the Pesach flesh. It's simply a trigger for remembering a heartier meal with the roasted meat that Pesach afforded us. But that's not in the Haggadah liturgy that says, instead of doing the mitzvah of matzah and then the mitzvah of maror with dipping, as the way to do these mitzvot. We're going to add a third way in case Hillel had it right. We don't say that. We don't say that because of a conclusion drawn in the Talmudic passage that we'll see about that aspect of the Seder night.
Can I ask a practical thing? What do you use for maror to dip?
So in order to have maror done, there are several options. One is you can use entirely bitter lettuce. So if you get the most bitter lettuce,
endive.
Right, endive is very bitter.
Mustard
greens are very bitter. And you eat a number of the leaves. Like what I will do is, in order to fulfill the mitzvah of maror, I will have, if we use endive, like 5 or 6 individual leaves, and you dip that into charoset, and you don't get like a whole. And this is the other thing I explained to my children. You know, this is not the excuse to use the endive like one of those wooden sticks for a Sunday cup. This is like, just dip it in and taste the bitterness. And so with each one, you kind of dip and you taste the bitterness. By the way, that's why some of the Eidot HaMizrach, the Jews from the Middle East, have a much pastier charoset. So that when you dip it in, a little bit more will stay on. You know, very smart. Very smart.
So we use horseradish.
Okay, so if you use horseradish,
yeah.
So we buy the real roots.
But I don't like dip the horseradish. I grate it. So it's not...
Okay, so take a spoonful. So take a spoonful.
Don't grate it.
Yeah, A, you don't have to grate it. B, if you do, you take a spoonful and you dip it with a spoon.
So that's essentially what we do.
And, you know, you eat the whole thing, and again, you don't want to pile on the charoset when you're actually doing that mitzvah of maror. Yeah, you want to do that for the kids, to make it a little fun, have them taste, you know, work them into the world of eating bitter. I think we could probably say that that's okay.
If the mitzvah of the Kabbalah is the achilat maror, it's the maror, why is the second dipping and not the first?
Nice question.
Why they didn't do the most important first and leave the rest to later?
Right. So, I think that the answer, they're not going to tell us explicitly, but I think that we could probably come up with some good answers now that you've asked the question.
It's getting you into the meal. That's,
yeah, but if achilat matzah is the important, the kiddush, there are importance of starting the seder. If the kiddush, the matzah. And the maror is the most important, so why it's not immediately on the order of importance? Why it's after a break that we have sweet stuff or other dipping with a lot of other stuff?
Good question.
Maybe it's like the order of blessings, when you have first say the daily thing you do and then leave the new thing for last. For Shechiano, for example, the order of blessings.
And what principle did the Gemara bring up back on page 101? Tadir v'she'eno tadir tadir kodem.
Right.
That which is more common and often done more often, done first, and then we do the other less often, the less regular practice we do later. So it's a nice way of thinking about the answer to the question. I'm not sure there's an answer here, but it's a nice application of a Gemara principle. The notion that you, here's an educational notion, you learn on a full stomach. You might fall asleep if you eat too much, but you learn with a little bit, like Barry mentioned after my explanation here of the dipping courses, that people are willing to sit through a little bit more Haggadah once we go through a little bit richer of an appetizer around. That's a very real consideration for me when I thought about this from a halachic standpoint. The other answer I'll say is that the rabbis set us up with the possibility that we've run to the Seder table, and there's no way we're going to gain our kavanah based on what we just read for maror and achilat maror k'mitzvah, the eating of the maror as this mitzvah we need to do, if we don't get ourselves into this. And also, as you mentioned, the Manishtana, which is going to be the next Mishnah that we study after we do a little bit more Gemara together, that's going to ultimately be principle for them to open up the possibilities that everyone gets and understands this symbolism, each at his or her own level. Chanoch al pidarko, that you have to educate everybody according to their own levels of their own abilities, their levels of understanding, and I think that they're warming us up for that. So, great discussion tonight. Good learning. We're having a lecture with Rabbi Wexler next week to touch upon this. I said to those who came after, so to those who came, and to touch upon the notion that who knows what the earliest experience of the Haggadah and the Pesach Seder was all about. Rabbi Wexler is going to cover a psalm that he said to me when we were talking about what we're learning, and one night I wanted him to come to the Beit Midrash. He said, oh, let me do a psalm. Is it the earliest Haggadah? So he's going to present a psalm and ask, is this the earliest Haggadah? And that's March 15th. March 22nd, just to give you the house, let's do the housekeeping. March 22nd, I'm inviting for a substitute. I have to be away for a community event on March 22nd, but I'm inviting for a substitute that evening, Rabbi Sarah Zachariah, with whom you've learned before. Sarah just recently was awarded, by the way, a fellowship that's called Present Tense, really pressing the envelope of how Talmud study and text study works in the modern marketplace of Jewish connections, unlike our community where people are connected through synagogue and our Beit Midrash, and this is ongoing culturally. She's bringing Gemara out to the ranks, so maybe she'll tell you a little bit about how she's conceived of Gemara study for the world out there. But moreover, she'll prepare some part of where we are in the Gemara and learn with the class while I'm at that community event on the 22nd. And then we have class the 29th, back to our material. And then I believe that the following week is the week before Pesach. And Rabbi, if you've not come to hear Rabbi Mordechai Schwartz from the seminary, who is just a wonderful, engaging, incredible scholar, coming to share more of his scholarship about Pesach material, comparing Talmud, Babylonian Talmud, Jerusalem Talmud, and Midrash. So we have a couple of weeks of real different ways of engaging our text study, and then post-Pesach we have several weeks where we just have a nice stretch of none of the holidays fall on Wednesdays, and there are no interruptions, and I'm looking forward to actually getting through a lot of materials. That's the housekeeping part. And welcome, Shachar, to come back, please, join us.
Thank you.
You will.